to anticipate a large audience for the Japanese No Theater, which will be, as I mentioned last week, in the UBC auditorium, the old auditorium building at the north end of the campus, which normally seats about 800. The proscenium will be sent out a little bit, and therefore we'll be deprived of about 100 seats. There are about 700, I imagine. And we think this will cause a great deal of interest. The No Theater has to have a proscenium, which is the reason we went to the, are going on the February the 15th to the old auditorium. And so for the members, there will be a tear sheet on this communique that I've sent out. And if you will kindly indicate the number of seats that you require for your family and send it back to the Center for Continuing Education, we will block off about 200 seats and hold them until 8 o'clock on the 15th of February, and then we'll have to let them go, of course, because it is a public lecture, and hope that we can keep seats for our members for a while anyway. The other thing is that for on that same tear sheet, I have asked for an indication of interest for those of you who missed the Margaret Mead lecture. We have a videotape, and if there is sufficient interest and response, we will try and arrange at the end of the whole series, after March 15th sometime, which will be announced, a videotape showing of the Margaret Mead lecture. The other thing is that next week, after Dr. Harry Warren's lecture, we will have a coffee in the lounge for the public. We do this once or twice during the year and hope that those who attend will be able to stay. I'd like to call on Dean Joe Gardner to introduce our speaker this evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. James F. Richards is a native of Winnipeg. He was educated at the University of Manitoba, where he obtained his Bachelor of Science and his Master of Science degree. He then went to the University of Minnesota, where he obtained his PhD. He came to UBC first in 1969 as assistant professor in the Department of Poultry Science in the Faculty of Agriculture. A few years ago, he helped others create the Food Science Department and is now a professor in that department in the Faculty of Agricultural Sciences. The high quality of his teaching and his research and his leadership in his profession have been widely recognized. 2 years ago, he was elected president of the Canadian Institute of Food Science and Technology, the national organization of food scientists in Canada. In his research, he is interested in the fundamental chemistry and physical aspects of food quality. Tonight, he's going to speak on the myth of organic foods. Professor James Richards.
Feel like I've been garroted. Is it on? Yes, you can hear. Well, Madam Chairman, Dean Gardner, members of the Institute, ladies and gentlemen, it's indeed a pleasure for me to be here this evening and a distinct honor to come and speak to you on the subject of the myth of organic foods. I'm particularly interested because in the title, the word food appears, and as from what Dean Gardner mentioned to you, I am vitally interested in food, and I think everybody is, and to a certain extent, because of the involvement we each have on a day-to-day basis with it, I think we have some claim to pretend we're pseudo-experts at least. There are many important issues pertaining to food today, and I think it's ever been so. one looks back in history, I don't think there's been a time when mankind has not had food as one of the primary issues and problems facing him in one form or another. One of the issues, will there be enough food? This question was the title of a recent editorial in Science, and it's been a central preoccupation of mankind for as long as recorded history. It finds expression in the motto of the Agricultural Institute of Canada, the organization of professional agrologists in Canada, Cibus ad omnes, food for all. It was brought into sharp focus by the World Food Conference in Rome last November, where it was pointed out that hundreds of millions of human beings live on the edge of starvation. In the long run, the only effective solution to the problem is a reduction in population growth rate. The desperate need for this was the motivation of the population conference in Bucharest. But in the meantime, we must eat, and that implies the need for a safe, nutritious food supply, a need that agriculture must meet. Agriculture has evolved from its early beginnings, when food was obtained by gathering seeds and berries and hunting animals, and when obtaining enough occupied all of man's time. It's progressed through the cultivation of plants and the domestication of animals, and it's incorporated the discoveries of natural and social science in its evolution to its present industrialized and highly efficient form. This agricultural revolution has allowed man to develop and explore his interests in other realms, in music, literature, philosophy, religion, and to live away from the land that supports him. It is recognized as a truly unique and fundamental phenomenon underlying man's recent evolution. Although the character and the degree of involvement of science and technology in support of agriculture varies among societies in the world, there's no major food-producing nation whose food supply in both amount and quality is not significantly dependent upon agricultural science and technology, in the form of improved seed and animal stock, mechanization, fertilization, pest control programs and materials and food preservatives. This system, as it's come to be known, the agro-ecosystem, is fundamentally different from natural ecosystems because of the presence of man. His needs and activities and development have led to the establishment of a highly productive agriculture, which, while critically dependent upon the conversion of solar energy by green plants, is also strongly subsidized by a massive infusion of fossil fuel. One American study has shown that an acre of corn now accounts for a total energy expenditure equivalent to 80 gallons of gasoline, roughly 1 gallon per bushel. And that, as more recent studies have shown, is only a quarter of the total energy cost of delivering the food to the ultimate consumer. Recent events concerning oil supplies have served to point up the vital link between fossil fuel and food supply. As I see it, the central task facing agriculture is, has been, and will continue to be for the foreseeable future, the wise management and development of the agroecosystem to maximize its contribution to man's need for nutrients and minimize untoward repercussions to an extent compatible with the goals of society. It is with that charge in mind that I should like to discuss the myth of organic foods with you. When the title was suggested to me, I could not help but think that the lecture would not have been out of place if it had been delivered in 1840, at the time of Justice Liebig's discoveries of the importance of inorganic elements to plant growth. For the issue of so-called organic food has been contentious ever since. Because many of the issues have been debated widely in the past, but also because I believe the recent rediscovery of organic foods is symptomatic of a more general syndrome, I propose to focus on one aspect of the issue, that pertaining to the use of agricultural and food chemicals, and to treat the others in a much less detailed manner. What is meant by the term organic foods, or more properly, organically grown foods? It's commonly used to refer to foods grown without the use of any agricultural chemicals and processed without the use of food additives. I think that definition finds wide acceptance. Thus, there are two aspects to consider, both the production and the processing. The production aspect, or organic farming, has a long history, but the organic movement as manifested today owes its origins primarily to the work of Sir Albert Howard, a botanist and plant pathologist whose Agricultural Testament, written in 1940, enunciates the postulates to which the movement still adheres. Nevertheless, it's difficult to identify precisely the tenets of the organic food movement that set it apart from more conventional approaches to food and agriculture. But there are several practices that are commonly recommended and serve to identify it. Firstly, the maintenance of soil fertility by the use of only composted organic materials and mulches. Secondly, the total avoidance of chemical pesticides and other agricultural chemicals such as growth promoters, soil conditioners, antibiotics, and so on. And thirdly, by the adherence, the consumption of only natural foods grown organically and minimally processed without the use of food additives of any type. Now, the major claims or reasons offered in support of these recommendations are that, first of all, modern agricultural methods, that is, the use of chemical fertilizers, if I can use that phrase, to differentiate them from organic matter, are depleting the soil of essential minerals and humus. Secondly, that a nutrient element from an inorganic fertilizer supplied to a plant is of poorer nutritional value for the purposes of plant growth than the same nutrient from an organic source. Thirdly, the nutritive value and flavor of foods grown organically are claimed to be superior. And finally, it is claimed that the residues of agricultural chemicals remaining in food and food additives which are put there intentionally are poisonous. To the extent that the organic movement underlines man's dependence on the fertility of the soil, agricultural scientists would support it, soilless culture notwithstanding. Langenkamp puts it well. He says, "Human vanity, it has been said, can best be served by a reminder that whatever his accomplishments, his sophistication, his artistic pretensions, man owes his very existence to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains." As the soil scientists in the audience could impress upon you much better than I, it is this upper layer of the Earth's crust where most of the organic matter with its high content of available nutrients is concentrated. And it is of the most immediate value in crop production. Organic matter, or humus, the decomposed form, is widely recognized as a valuable ingredient of many soils. It improves soil tilth through granulation of the soil particles. It increases water holding capacity, slows erosion, and releases nitrogen and other nutrients that are present to crops. Once productive soils can become barren due to depletion of organic matter following excessive cultivation, and restoration of these soils requires replenishment of the organic matter. The idea that soil fertility can be maintained only by the return of compost and the use of mulches is basic to the organic movement, as I mentioned. In fact, it is commonly expounded that the use of chemical fertilizers poisons the soil and ruins our health, and for this reason, only compost should be used. Evidence for this claim is lacking, and in any event, total reliance on natural soil microorganisms to provide via the decay processes the total nutrient requirement for crops restricts a piece of land to its innate capabilities. Properly formulated chemical fertilizers can be effective in correcting mineral deficiencies and in providing supplementary nutrients, notably but not exclusively nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, enabling significant increases in yield and thereby increasing soil humus. For the major source of soil organic matter is plant tissue from both roots and aerial parts. The increased yield from the use of chemical fertilizers not only contributes to increased humus in the soil, but perhaps more importantly, the additional food harvested is vitally necessary in a world where an extrapolation of present population growth rates predicts a doubling of food requirements in the next generation. The claim of superiority of nutrients from organic sources for plant growth has never been supported by experimental evidence. This is not unexpected, since it is a well-known fact that with the exception of hydrogen, carbon, and oxygen, plant absorption of nutrients is almost wholly from inorganic salts or as ions released by weathering and biological action in natural soils. Thus, whether the nutrient was originally supplied as part of an organic or inorganic fertilizer is of no particular consequence to the plant. As a result chiefly of the weathering and biological activity, there occurs a continuous cycling of the mineral nutrients required by plants. A given quantity of one of them may be taken up from soil solution or soil by a growing plant and be returned to the soil when the plant dies and decomposes. Now, under virgin conditions or in natural ecosystems, the cycling may go on indefinitely with only minor losses to drainage and to the air. However, where the crop is removed or consumed by livestock or by man, only a portion of the element is returned. The organic movement lays great stress on the return of all crop residues and all animal and human wastes, an admirable objective. But even if this is done, there is a deficiency of nutrients. Maintenance of high crop yield is possible under this system only if one land area is built up at the expense of another. Alternatively, the deficiencies can be compensated for by the use of properly constituted chemical fertilizers. The claim of superior nutritional quality of organically grown foods, both plant and animal, derives really from the preceding ones. Numerous attempts have been made to investigate this hypothesis, and all have failed to establish any such difference. That does not seem to deter the leaders of the organic movement. Robert Rodale, the son of J.I. Rodale, recently deceased, who was the modern-day founder of the movement in North America, makes the following statement in one of his many books published recently in 1973. Organic food is grown in soil that is rich in organic matter and therefore has superior nutritional quality. That evidence for this claim is not likely to be forthcoming is due to the fact that the source of nutrients does not influence the composition of the plant in regard to its content of protein, fat, carbohydrate, or vitamins. These factors are influenced primarily by genetic composition of the seed, maturity of the plant at harvest, and at least for some plants by bioclimatic factors such as temperature. In addition, the mineral content of plants is influenced by availability of minerals in the soil. Iodine, zinc, cobalt, and selenium have all been found to vary in crops from different locations, and the difference is attributable to soil content. Such deficiencies are readily corrected by the appropriate fertilizer, of course, and the subsequent crops thereby improved as either feed or food. The fact that mineral deficiencies in plants can result from soil deficiencies is not evidence to support the claim of superior nutrition for organically fertilized plants. On the contrary, it indicates that crops grown on deficient soils without the appropriate fertilizer could be of lower nutritive value for either animals or man than the corresponding properly fertilized crop. Superior nutritive value of organically raised animals is also claimed. It's not clear to me whether organically grown animals must be fed only organically grown grain, or if only the absence of hormones, antibiotics, and drugs, etc., from the rearing program is necessary for the animal to qualify as organic. In either case, there's neither reason to expect nor evidence to support the notion that nutritive value of animal products is influenced by the organicness of the rearing program. It's reported that when asked why organic fertilizing was superior to chemical fertilizing, J.I. Rodale replied, "We feel that in organically grown food, you have things you don't even know exist." This has reminded others of the couplet from Hilaire Belloc's The Microbe. After noting that no one had ever seen a microbe, he states, "Oh, let us never, never doubt that which no one knows about." It should also be noted that the corollary argument that is sometimes put forth, that there are probably unknown nutritive substances present in organically grown food, not present in those grown with chemicals, is just as likely to be true in the reverse. Organic foods are also claimed to be of superior sensory quality. Listen to Robert Rodale again. Organic food varies in quality according to the area in which it is grown, but almost always it has that good old-fashioned taste which is sadly lacking in supermarket food. He goes on to say, organic vegetables, grains, and meats almost always look better as well as taste better. They have a glow of quality and a taste of nature. Once again, there is no evidence to substantiate the claim. Certainly, it's possible for there to be a real difference in taste between organic and conventional produce. But the likelihood is equally great for the existence of a difference between two organic apples as between two conventional ones. An important factor in determining the taste of both plant and animal products is the length of time and type of handling after harvest or slaughter. I know few people who do not prefer the flavor of garden fresh produce, but this cannot be assured any more readily by organic farming than by conventional methods. Organic food proponents also decry the use of pesticides and intentional food additives in food production and processing. In the case of pesticides, the denial of their use is predicated on the claim that insects and plant diseases are not serious menaces to crop production if all chemicals are excluded from farming and nature's methods only are used. This hardly needs refuting, for it is a common biological phenomenon for the organisms of a natural ecosystem to fluctuate in number over time in a somewhat erratic pattern. It is this very uncertainty that spurred the development of many of the instruments of modern agriculture. Even now, the position of organic supporters on this question is shifting, as it is recognized that while the planting of chives at the base of peach trees to control borers, or the planting of marigolds to control nematodes, or using ladybugs to control aphids and stoop labor to pick potato bugs or tomato worms is all very interesting and useful at the home gardening level, where the uncertainty of the results is not particularly important, it is quite another matter to recommend them as the only acceptable approach for intensive agriculture. This is not to say that biological control of pests and diseases is not a valid approach, for it most certainly is. But it is one approach of several that must be integrated in proper combination if man is to continue to reap sufficient food from this planet. Each method has its advantages and disadvantages, and each situation calls for informed judgment as to how the problem can be solved best. For instance, it is sometimes essential to achieve pest control rapidly to protect a major crop from destruction by a sudden infestation of insects due to a natural fluctuation in numbers. Chemical pesticides in many cases offer the only means of control of such situations. I can think of the armyworm infestation in Saskatchewan of a few years ago that was predicted and was known to be coming. The only effective control was chemical pesticides. In other cases, such biological control procedures as the release of sterile males, as in the Okanagan project for the control of the coddling moth, was recently written up in local papers, or the breeding of disease-resistant crops or animals, may be the most effective approach. The use of chemical pesticides and chemical fertilizers necessarily entails some risk. In this regard, they are similar to food additives. Both are utilized to obtain a particular benefit, and their use entails a certain risk. The type and degree of risk varies with individual compounds and method of use. With chemical fertilizers, there's risk of pollution of associated waterways by improper or excessive use. Pesticides can also constitute a risk to the environment by unwanted effects on fish, wildlife, plant life, and so on. And many pesticides are toxic to man, some more than others. So there's hazard due to the residues, which may remain on crops or animals and be consumed by man, no question about it. Similarly, the hazard from intentional food additives, to the extent that one exists, arises from the presence of the additive in food. Perhaps a word about what qualifies as a food additive would be in order. Some people differentiate between intentional and incidental food additives, the latter encompassing what I've referred to as agricultural chemicals. It is intentional food additives to which the unqualified term usually refers, and I would propose to use it in that sense. There are regulatory definitions of food additives, and as one might expect, they're not consistent among countries, at least not completely. Canada's definition excludes certain materials, specifically such as nutritive materials, vitamins, minerals, and so on, seasonings, spices, flavorings, and agricultural chemicals are specifically included. They are not, in a regulatory sense, food additives. They are accommodated under other regulations in the Act, however. But this legalistic sort of definition is a little too constraining, and I would propose to use the more common one, and that is that food additives are compounds purposely introduced to aid in processing or to preserve or improve quality. This encompasses many functions and many compounds. Preservatives, such as calcium propionate, nitrites, natural and synthetic colors, antioxidants, such as ascorbic acid, emulsifiers, such as lecithin, chemical leaveners, decolorizers, and all kinds of nutrient supplements. They are all chemical compounds of one type or another, some synthetically produced, others derived from natural sources. There are risks from their use, as I've said, but there are also very significant benefits which accrue from the use of agricultural chemicals and food additives. Some of them are obvious, such as the increase in yield or growth, which results from the use of appropriate chemical fertilizers, the increase in growth rate from the use of DES, diethylstilbestrol, in cattle, now not permitted in Canada, and the prophylactic use of antibiotics in the raising of poultry. Perhaps the most dramatic benefit is the prevention of crop losses to insects and disease by the use of pesticides. Faced with the burgeoning population, the social and moral desirability of increasing food production seems to me to be undeniable. That many of these strategies provide the increased yield at significantly lower cost than alternative approaches increases their appeal. The justification for the use of food additives may not be quite so obvious, but the nations of the world have met under joint Food and Agriculture Organization and World Health Organization sponsorship and have agreed on some common rationales for the use of additives, and these pertain through many countries of the world. Broadly, the justifications for use are firstly the improvement or maintenance of nutritive value, secondly the enhancement of keeping quality or stability with resultant reduction in wastage. Third, the improvement in acceptability and availability of food. And finally, the provision of essential processing or preparation aids. Whether a particular agricultural or food chemical is permitted depends upon the results of judgments made about the relative benefits and risks. Now, the phrase risk-benefit analysis has become commonplace in recent years, and it's used to refer to everything from the very formal and reasonably precise application in engineering design to the very informal balancing of risks and benefits widely practiced by each of us in daily decision making. I will have more to say about risk-benefit procedures in relation to food additives, but first I'd like to comment on some of the other hazards of eating. A half a dozen sources of hazard associated with food are widely recognized. Microbiological, nutritional, environmental contaminants, natural toxicants, and pesticide residues and food additives make up the list. Although it's difficult to be fully quantitative about the hazard from each of the sources, the experience of regulatory agencies and others closely involved with food safety suggests that the extent of hazard, from greatest to least, probably coincides with the order of listing. That is, microbiological and nutritional are the most hazardous, and pesticides and additives the least. This sometimes appears unrealistic, to those who rely heavily on the popular press or radio or television for information. A couple of years ago, Dr. Virgil Wotica of the Food and Drug Administration in the United States compared the actual hazard ranking with a ranking based on press comment. And as you might expect, the top items in press coverage included pesticide residues and food additives. The point is that the importance of the hazard is not necessarily a function of the number of column inches devoted to it. Microbiological and nutritional hazards are easily recognized as two important ones. The consumption of improperly processed and handled food leads to an estimated minimum of 200,000 cases of food poisoning every year in Canada. The specific cases range from mild to severe gastrointestinal disorders, which frequently are not reported, to death from ingestion of botulinum toxin, and we still have a few every year. The hazard from less than optimum nutrition arises from an improper selection of foods, leading one to become either under, over, or malnourished. And according to Nutrition Canada, all conditions exist in British Columbia today. The hazard is increased by those who encourage the belief that certain foods are essential to optimum nutrition. Carried to extremes, this can lead to some bizarre food habits. Epitomized by the Zen macrobiotic diet, even more broadly based vegetarian diets, in the hands of those who are not fully conversant with nutrient requirements, can be hazardous. There have been some heartbreaking cases of malnutrition documented from vegetarian communes in California recently. Even among people who have received instruction in nutrition principles, the influence of custom, tradition, and psychological factors may easily override reason. Listen to Dr. Magnus Pike, the noted Scottish food scientist, when he says, "Teaching the science of nutrition to ordinary members of a society who have little interest in science exerts a minimal effect on health. People do not appear to learn the facts and principles of nutrition, and even when they do, commonly decline to behave accordingly." It's clear, then, that the risk of less than optimum nutrition is largely due to the behavior of the consumer in selecting and preparing food. Now, the hazards from environmental and naturally occurring toxicants can also be easily documented. The possibility of toxic heavy metals such as lead, cadmium, or mercury entering our food supply has been of long concern, and in recent years, much interest is focused on mercury in some of our freshwater lakes and the fish that we harvest from them. The possibility of a health hazard from mercury has led to the establishment of tolerance levels for this metal in food as a control measure. Almost every food contains one or more naturally occurring toxic substances, for almost every chemical compound can be shown to be toxic given the right conditions and quantity, even nutrients. For this reason, the consumption of even modest quantities of polar bear liver, something that we don't do every day, can be very injurious to health because it has an exceptionally high concentration of vitamin A. Nutrition Canada has recently warned of the hazard of vitamin D supplementation of diets for otherwise well-nourished pregnant women for a similar reason. The alkaloid solanin, the same substance found in the foliage of the deadly nightshade plant, is often present in potatoes, particularly if exposed to the sun, with less than a tenfold safety factor between the normal level and the level which has caused human poisoning. Oxalates and free oxalic acid in spinach, almonds, cocoa, and tea are potentially hazardous. Nutmeg contains myristicin, a hallucinogen, and small quantities of safrole, a carcinogen. Goitrogens, compounds which promote goiter, are present in many foods, including turnips, pears, carrots, and rapeseed. The myriad of chemicals which constitute natural foods each have a certain intrinsic capacity to produce injury. However, the hazard or risk arising from the consumption of even highly toxic chemicals, such as arsenic, lead, mercury, or fluorine, depends upon the conditions of consumption. There are several reasons for this, but most importantly, the concentration of each of the toxic substances is most in most commonly accepted foods is so low relative to their toxicity that grossly exaggerated amounts have to be ingested for extended periods of time before the toxicity is translated into a hazard. Thus, it is possible to establish a no effect level for most toxicants. For example, the lycopene, the red pigment in tomato juice, does not normally constitute a hazard, but it has been documented to have been injurious to an individual who consumed a half a gallon daily for several years. In a similar vein, thyroid enlargement from the goitrogenic factor in cauliflower would require a daily consumption of about 20 pounds. These hazards from naturally occurring toxicants have been with us for a long time, and many of the microbiological and environmental hazards are familiar enough that we seem able to live with them. We see them as a manageable risk. It's true that some new ones are discovered from time to time, and because of their newness, they can be frightening. The discovery not many years ago of the potent carcinogen aflatoxin in peanuts and peanut products resulting from mold contamination has given rise to rigid surveillance and regulation of peanuts used in food manufacture in this country. A recent communique from the Health Protection Branch has established a new actionable level for this compound of 15 parts per billion as of April 1, 1975. This is a decrease from the previous actionable limit of 20 parts per billion, and it was brought about because of improvements in analytical methodology. So even though a few years ago it was new and frightening, we've learned to live with it. Similarly, regulations concerning nutritional and microbiological hazards are designed to minimize the likelihood of injury from these sources. There exist microbiological standards for many foods and requirements for nutrient fortification of many others, both in the interests of public health. We seem to manage these hazards well, but how do we fare with regard to food additives and agricultural chemicals? Well, there are many compounds in these classes, and each has a certain toxicity. However, the proposition underlying their use is that although all chemicals are toxic, there are safe ways of using them to obtain benefit for man. In this context, safe means virtual, never absolute certainty that no harm will result from the consumption of the chemical in question. This concept is old and well established. It was expressed well by the Renaissance physician Paracelsus when he said, "Sola dosis facit venenum," only the dose makes the poison. The problem is to establish the safe dose. A detailed discussion of all the principles on which the safety of food chemicals is based is not possible, but I should point out that these have evolved under the auspices of both national and international agencies, again in particular FAO and WHO. In Canada, the procedures to be followed and the information to be prepared in support of the use of a food additive is carefully delineated. The data required pertain to toxicological properties, the metabolic fate of the additive, sensitization, residue accumulation, and so on. The decision as to whether use is permitted and at what levels is based on careful assessment of this and other data. Central to the question of whether an additive is to be permitted is the establishment of a no effect level. That is a quantity which, when administered according to certain protocols, has no deleterious effect on the test organism. The claim is made by some that for certain compounds, particularly carcinogens, there is no threshold or no effect level. This issue remains unresolved and is a central question of science today. Much of the criticism of the so-called Delaney Amendment in the United States by the scientific community is that by declaring that no chemical additive may be approved for use if it is found to induce cancer, period, is that the question has been prejudged. Even if the concept of a no effect level is accepted, establishment of it suffers from all the difficulties of proving a negative. The inherent uncertainty in the procedure is taken into account, however, in establishing safe or acceptable intake levels for man by dividing the estimated no effect level obtained by test organisms by a factor, commonly 100, sometimes greater, rarely less, to arrive at a safe intake level, or the acceptable daily intake, as it's referred to. Subsequently, comparison with the actual probable intake of the additive by man determines whether it will be permitted to be used. In many cases, the acceptable daily intake is many times higher than the probable intake, thus introducing an additional margin of safety. Some of the bannings which we see from time to time, or the removal of approvals for certain chemicals, is because the margin is shrinking. And that's the only reason in many cases, not that there's been any demonstrated harm. Even if a compound is found to be safe, it still must offer some distinct benefit before it will be permitted. The weighing of the risks and the benefits, culminating in a decision, calls for a great deal of wisdom to ensure that society is well served. Whether the procedures followed in establishing safe levels of additives or agricultural chemical residues in foods result in a solution of the risk-benefit equation that is satisfactory to you depends on many factors. In general, it depends on how closely your views of the benefits and risks coincide with those of the regulatory agencies who approve the use or set the standards on your behalf. It is true that what constitutes an acceptable risk varies with the attendant benefits. Dr. Richard Hall, a member of the Panel on Chemicals and Health of the President's Science Advisory Committee in the United States and a past president of the Institute of Food Technologists, has classified risks and benefits as vital or non-vital. His view is that because in North American society food is not viewed as a vital benefit, that is, it's taken for granted that there will be enough, it therefore shocks us to find that there are some vital risks associated with its consumption. Particularly disturbing to some people is that some of the justifications for food additive use seem to be not only not vital, but to lead to frivolous applications. It should be remembered that food is more than the input to nutrition for man. It satisfies social, cultural, emotional, religious needs, as well as physiological ones. Satisfying those needs can be a vital benefit, whether we recognize it or not. The World Health Organization defines health as including complete physical, mental, and social well-being, in addition to the absence of disease or infirmity. Thus, contributions to any of those aspects of health might be construed as vital benefits. It must also be remembered that not all foods are equivalent in their relative contribution to nutritional, psychological, and social value. Thus, we permit the manufacture of and make our choices from thousands of different food items, each making a different contribution. Nevertheless, one can recognize some priorities among the benefits, and meeting physiological needs is clearly the most significant benefit in my mind. In fact, most of the justifications for additive and agricultural chemical use have to do with that objective in very pragmatic ways. That is, the prevention of nutrient losses or restoring those removed, inhibiting spoilage, and improving palatability. However, there is a continuous need to ensure that the justifications for food additive use are not undermined. Such concern was demonstrated in the report of the Panel on Food Safety at the White House Conference on Food, Nutrition, and Health held a few years ago in the U.S., and more recently by the third joint FAO-WHO Conference on Food Additives and Contaminants held in 1973. The Panel on Food Safety recommended that no new additive should be allowed unless they could be shown to be significantly less toxic than additives currently used for the same purpose, to significantly improve quality or acceptability, to significantly increase food supply, to improve nutritive value, or decrease cost to the consumer. The FAO-WHO meeting, in a more general way, called for much more careful study at national and international levels to ensure adherence to the principles of justification. So there seems to be a new awakening to the concern with maintaining the standards of justification for food additive use. And some would say it's long overdue. There will always be those who honestly disagree with the decisions pertaining to protection of public health, and society must provide the means for them to be heard. The questions they ask are valid, and they represent a gauge against which decision-making bodies may judge their interpretation of what constitutes a socially acceptable risk and benefit. The decisions reached can never be viewed as final. As science continues to progress, more and new knowledge comes to light and must be assimilated. There are numerous examples where reassessment based on new information has taken place. Sometimes this takes the form of establishing tolerances where none existed before, such as for mercury. Sometimes withdrawal of approval for an additive. At other times, granting approval for an additive use. And sometimes requiring addition of nutrients to foods, as has been done in specific cases as a result of Nutrition Canada. You may be interested to know that as of April, unless there's any change in the policy, that vitamin A and D will now be required in a wide range of milk products rather than being optional additives. And thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, and iron will be required in flour and some other flour products. This is as a direct result of the findings of Nutrition Canada. However, when the new information points to new or increased toxicity of a compound and perhaps results in withdrawal of approval, public skepticism of science and decision makers rises perceptibly. The withdrawal of approval for the use of cyclamates and the reduction in the permitted residual amounts of nitrite in cured meat are two recent examples of changes as a result of new information on toxicity. There will be more discoveries. There will be more adjustments and hopefully greater wisdom. For we're really only beginning to understand the chemical, biological, and physical properties of the compounds that constitute food. And as Dr. Margaret Mead pointed out to this institute 2 short weeks ago, we haven't shown much wisdom in our judgment of the relative importance of the nutritional, political, and economic dimensions of food. Science does not possess wisdom or make moral judgments. Only man does. As Will and Ariel Durant put it in the Lessons of History, one of the discouraging discoveries of our disillusioning century is that science is neutral. It will kill for us as readily as it will heal. This should not be construed as denying the role of scientists in the decision process, however. They are unquestionably the most competent group to assess the hazards and benefits of food and agricultural chemical use. However, it is my contention that the representation in science must be broad. And some would argue, as did the panel on chemicals and health recently in the United States, that scientists and non-scientists working in concert could evolve more rational policy and regulatory decisions concerning complex matters of health and the quality of life than either could alone. I'm inclined to agree. The reason is self-evident and summarized well by Alvin Weinberg's description of these problems and questions as trans-scientific, beyond the ken of science alone to answer. Well, this discussion of the hazards associated with food and the related decision-making process has been intended to make the point that there are many hazards from several sources, and the contribution to the total from food additives and agricultural chemicals is, to the best of present knowledge, small, and present only because of the benefits derived. The question as to whether substituting organic foods for conventional foods will make any important differences in exposure to risk or in the benefits derived is, in the last analysis, a personal judgment. My own evaluation is that the risks from agricultural and food chemicals are far outweighed by the benefits that I and I think society enjoy. This is not to say that I do not question some of the uses to which food additives are put, or some of the misuses of agricultural chemicals. Certainly there have been errors and misjudgments because of the inevitable incompleteness of our knowledge and our inability to guarantee perfection in application. It is also abundantly clear that the evolution of agriculture must continue, and that we must intensify our research efforts with a view to lowering the non-renewable energy cost that I mentioned earlier, and reducing the environmental impact of food production. Challenges that promise to be a central theme of agricultural research for some decades. Although the use of fertilizers, pesticides, and food additives is not without disadvantages, and some of our present methods will be supplanted by improved ones, the benefits derived from the rational use of agricultural and food chemicals have been and are presently undeniably vital. For this reason, and because the other claims concerning agronomic advantage and nutritional and sensory quality superiority have not been substantiated, I find the case for organic food unconvincing. In the sense that a myth is an invented story or concept or an unproved collective belief, I find many of the claims of the organic food movement to be mythical. As to the implicit claim that it offers a viable alternative to modern scientific agriculture and food processing, or a model towards which it should evolve, denies the nature and history of man. Its methods could not sustain the yields nor provide the product stability needed to feed mankind in any but the most agrarian of societies. I recognize that others may reach a different conclusion, and that many do seems to be attested to by the popularity of these products. It's dismaying to me to think that it might be the very mythical nature of the movement which attracts adherents. We hear much about a revival of interest in the mystical in some segments of our population. Other observers have suggested that users derive psychological satisfaction from purchasing organic foods as a means of relieving their frustrations with a technological society, with intellectualism and science. Still others may opt for organic food as a means of expressing an interest in ecology and the preservation of the environment, which they mistakenly believe is not a primary concern of agricultural science. The motivation for use may vary, and it's difficult to determine the numbers who are attracted to organic food for different reasons. My suspicion is that much of the interest and concern centers on the idea that because we do not have complete knowledge about the hazards from agricultural and food chemical use, and because our judgment as to what is safe has been faulty in some cases, that is sufficient reason to forsake conventional for organic food. There is a certain logic in the argument, but each substitution needs to be judged on its own merits to ensure that one small risk is not being traded for another. As pointed out earlier, some notable hazards arise from naturally occurring compounds and microorganisms in food. An historical review reveals that much injury to human health has resulted from natural components of foods and microorganisms. But essentially, no similar injury can be attributed to food additives or pesticides used in a prescribed manner. In fact, to a significant extent, agricultural and food chemicals are used to counteract many of these natural hazards. Thus, one could argue, perhaps with equal logic, that only conventional food should be consumed. In conclusion, I would challenge you to weigh carefully the benefits and the risks in the application of science and technology to the task of providing food for man, and to strive to reach a position on the question of organic versus conventional foods on the basis of fact, not fancy. Thank you.
Professor Richards will answer questions. Yes.
Pardon?
If you have any visceral knowledge of organic food.
I'm not sure that I understand the question entirely, but
organic food for any period of time.
Not for an extended period of time.
So you don't know what you're talking about.
That's one interpretation. Yes.
Considered
repeat that, please?
I don't know that I can repeat all of that. I think the thrust of the question is to know whether the university receives grants from industry, and the answer to that is yes. Yes. What's the question?
The question is, I can't understand at this late date, with all the information known about nitrosamines, that you would still consider it useful to use nitrates in preserving food, specifically when Russia made its studies in 1970, which proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was a definite potent carcinogen.
Hear, hear.
I think the point that I was trying to make during the talk, particularly with regard to nitrates and the nitrosamines that Kin developed therefrom, was that this was one case where evidence has come to light in the last few years that nitrates are not as innocuous as was commonly thought. You know, nitrates originally found their way into the food supply accidentally as a contaminant of salt in the curing of meat or the brining of meat. And it was not until the 1920s that it was discovered that it was the nitrite contamination that was doing a couple of things. One, that was imparting the pink color, but more importantly, it seemed to be inhibiting the sporulation of Clostridium botulinum, which exists and is very widely known and is a hazard in pasteurized products such as canned semi-preserved hams. And so the justification for using it, even before it was known that it had carcinogenic activity, was because of this particular benefit. Now, the observation that nitrite could be converted to nitrosamines in the stomach came out with quite a splash, but it was realized subsequently that the source of man's nitrite was not to any great extent from meats. But he was getting a lot more from a lot of other things. But then the evidence indicated that, in fact, the conversion could take place in the product itself before consumption. And that got everybody very worried. The initial response, I haven't been following it that closely, but the initial response in Canada was a decrease in the permissible level of nitrite in the product from 200 parts per million, I think, residual to 20 parts per million, a very dramatic drop. And this is beginning to show up in some cured products on the market because they're not evenly pink anymore. They tend to be a little bit gray. But the antibacterial effect is still all right at the 20 part per million level. So that was the initial step. What the next step will be, I don't know. I suspect that it will be removed from approval. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised. The evidence is still coming in, and I think some of the evidence you've cited is quite recent. And certainly, as far as I know, is being taken into account by the Health Protection Branch. And I'd be very surprised if we don't see a pretty major development in terms of nitrite soon. I know the meat industry is very concerned because they're not prepared. There's a tremendous amount of work going on now looking for alternatives to nitrite to get the same preservative effect. And they're still trying to obtain the same color effect. Whether they'll be successful or not, I don't know. It may mean that some of the semi-preserved products will not be able to be manufactured. They'll just have to go to a more thorough thermal exposure.
Could I just have one more question? I also believe that you're in favor of red number 2. I think I remember reading an article where you supported the use of red number 2 with this.
Don't think anybody's ever polled me on red number 2.
I think I have something in
Do you? Well, at least I have a fan club of one.
And I'd like to know what you think about red number two.
I really haven't kept up to date on red number two.
You don't think it's a carcinogen?
I didn't say that. I said I haven't kept up to date on it, so I really couldn't enter into an informed debate on it right here.
Red number two is the one color that's used the most in Canada for just about everything, including ice creams. And our children are the ones that eat the major portion of ice creams. And I would like to see these carcinogenic coal tar dyes and azo dyes removed from any product, particularly that our children consume. And I think Canada has been way behind on some of these issues.
Well, I think you're expressing, you know, an attitude that is not very far off what's getting to be the majority, I think. You know, one has to look at the development of these things in some kind of historical perspective to understand them. And I think in my own analysis, what's happened is that immediately after World War II, there was a tremendous rush to produce more and new foods. And frankly, the application of standards was not as tight as we could make it now, partly because we didn't have the science to base it on, and partly because the particular model and system that we had wasn't designed for that. It was designed to get more and better food on the market. I think now we're doing a second look and a reiteration at the whole thing, and I think we're going to see some fundamental shifts. I don't have any official information, but I wouldn't be at least bit surprised to see an announcement concerning the Health Protection Branch and how it's going to assess benefits and risks and how it's going to relate with the public. I think you'll see a major change in this being announced before very long.
There's one down here.
Yes.
Richard, in view of the significant number of pesticides proven hazardous and now discarded, do you not feel quite dissatisfied with the ratio of investment in research and development of biological controls versus chemical controls?
To repeat that for the people.
The question was, because many of the chemical pesticides that have been developed have now been discarded, do I not feel that there should be more money spent on biological than chemical control? I think that was the sense of the question, was it not?
Yes.
Well, I think I find the biological control approach most appealing, and I applaud the efforts that are going on now in the area. I really can't say whether the ratio should be higher than it is now. I don't even know exactly what it is at the moment. But I think the biological control approach is a very effective approach in certain situations. But at the same time, I would, for instance, hate to see all monies shifted from chemical or second generation type pesticides into biological control methods, and find that in the meantime, we haven't got anything available to handle the problem until we get the biological control method worked out. One has to go at this in a gradual evolution. I don't think you can impose a major dislocation. It's the same sort of thing that it would happen if you were to, from above, impose an overnight ban on all food additives, as some people I think would like to do. The dislocation and effect on lifestyle, and more importantly on nutritional well-being and health, would be disastrous. The question was concerning the testing of food additives individually with disregard to the interaction effects and the cumulative effects. And the second part, I've forgotten, sorry. It was short memory. You've forgotten too. That's interesting.
Also, that the factor of biochemical individuality
and
taken into consideration as far as we can see as people outside the government.
Okay, and the fact that each individual is different metabolically. Well, I think the first part of the question, you put your finger on a very contentious issue. It's not that it has been ignored, and I don't mean to stand here and speak for the Health Protection Branch because they're quite able to do this on their own, but I know for a fact that it has not been ignored. The standard protocols of toxicology, as I understand them, and I'm no toxicologist, is to test chemicals in an individual fashion. Sometimes when the evidence warrants it, and this is a decision that has to be taken by scientists in the area, there is testing done with more than one compound present and in different kinds of diets. Sometimes the effect of a compound can be very severe, for instance, in a low protein diet, whereas if the protein is adequate in the diet, no effect is demonstrable by such methods. As to the question of biochemical individuality, it's certainly a real one. There's a count taken of it, as far as I know, on the basis of the evidence that exists as to the range of differences in terms of metabolic pathways and metabolism. Certainly there's consideration given to situations of disabilities or lack of enzymes and particular metabolic pathways in the testing procedure. As I say, someone from Health Protection who's involved on a day-to-day basis could give you the nitty-gritty answer to that. But I do know that it is taken into account. Perhaps not to the full satisfaction of you, and perhaps not to the full satisfaction of me, actually. But it's a matter of balance in all questions.
There's a way one way up there.
Yeah,
yes? Can't say that I've read that, no?
Well, Dr. Randolph is an allergist and he resides in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
May the 14th and May the 15th last year, the Vatican Sun carried two articles on a global family. Their 10-year-old youngster apparently has to subsist on wild game and, quote, organically grown fruit and vegetables, mm-hmm. unquote.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I didn't say that there were not people who were allergic to additives. There most certainly seem to be from the evidence that's accumulating, and it's an unfortunate situation. But by the same token, I'd like to make two points. One is that people are allergic to a lot of things. There are people who are allergic to the protein in wheat, for instance, and they have a difficult time getting along as well. And I wonder, really, if we were wise enough to make the judgment on behalf of society, if we really should prevent the use of an additive for a good purpose, for the provision of improved nutritional value, let's say, for the majority of the population, or even 99%, whether we should prevent that from happening because there is a small percentage that are going to have difficulty, provided this is done with full information. I wonder.
According to Dr. Benjamin Fine, pardon, Bernard Feingold, he is the chief allergist of
yes.
the Kaiser Permanente Hospital in San Francisco.
Yes, I'm aware.
And he attributes the greatest percentage of hyperkinesis
yes.
in young children to the presence of food allergies that are proliferating.
Yes, I'm aware.
They are chemically related to aspirin, and they are salicylates. And the thing is this, that hyperkinesis is one of the major problems with our young people today.
Yes. Yes, I'm quite well aware of that. I haven't read Dr. Feinberg's book, but I saw it reviewed in the newspaper yesterday or today, and it seems to me that it wasn't the majority he was talking about. In his case, I think the reviewer said that he had a 50% response, which certainly could be significant depending on how the experiment is set up. And I don't argue with his findings. I have no basis on which to dispute them. But I come back to the point of saying that we know of a lot of allergies and untoward effects from a lot of things in our environment. The question comes down to, as I was trying to say, trying to weigh the good versus the bad and obtain the maximum benefit.
Question up there, a woman, too.
Is there a lady up there? Well, I think I think the point was that organic gardening, on even on a small scale, offers an attempt to bring about some change in the commercial agricultural methodology. And the second part of the question was that if I said there was no proof for the benefits of organic farming, what are the proofs for the benefits of conventional agriculture? Is that a fair interpretation? Well, I think in the first part I would agree that perhaps for some people organic gardening is an attempt to set a model towards which commercial agriculture might evolve, and I suggested that in the talk. For other people, I think it's just a very enjoyable way of getting some exercise, which we all desperately need. And I think it's a very effective way of producing some food at a pretty reasonable cost if you have access to a piece of ground, and I'd hardly recommend it. Whether it's an effective way of changing the way things are done on a commercial scale in agriculture or not, I would find quite problematical. My own conclusion is that it is not, because I can't see in the foreseeable future that we're going to end up with that sort of agriculture without any agricultural chemicals or food additives. I can see us moving back from the use of chemicals and food additives to a point where we are ensuring that their use is absolutely necessary in every case, and so we may end up using somewhat less. But I don't see us substituting great gobs of labor for chemicals. I just can't see it in the way our society is structured now, unless we have some cataclysmic changes, which some people like to predict. Can't remember what the second part of the question was now.
There's a woman up in this corner.
Yes. Yes? Yes, I said that inorganic fertilizers or chemical fertilizers could be an effective source of mineral nutrients that are deficient. It is possible that they can be added from other sources, no question, but again, my point would be if one tries to do this on a large scale, you find either the source is not available in sufficient amount, not readily available, or that on an economic basis, and that is still a factor in this society, it just can't compete. It can't compete. But certainly on a small scale, there's no reason why you shouldn't try and use an organic source if you want. Yes.
To take exception to the last statement, Dr. Richards.
What am I saying?
Point out the example of the Jura brand products in Manitoba. Now, this is an association of about 20 farmers who among them control some 30,000 acres of prime agricultural land in Manitoba, and they are dedicated to growing food strictly organically. Okay. They've been doing so for about the last 3 years with tremendous success. The means that they use for increasing the nutrient content of their soil is by applying a trace mineral powder, which is very high in trace minerals, which they are able to import from, I believe it's Utah. And they found that within 2 years' time, the benefits of using this versus chemical fertilizer was equally effective at a fraction of the cost. And this is 30,000 acres of prime.
Can you repeat that?
So definitely, there is some evidence to show that it can be carried out on a large scale method effectively.
The point that was being made was that the gentleman was recounting an experience in Manitoba where a group of farmers have 30,000 acres under cultivation and they're able to use an imported source of organic mineral nutrients from the United States to carry out their fertilization program. I must admit I was not aware of that. I find it an interesting experiment. I would raise one question with it, and that is that it really is nothing but a scaled up version of the home garden. And if one were to operate it again on the large scale, one might find the difficulties a little more challenging than trying to maintain it even on 30,000 acres, which sounds like a lot, but compared to the total prairie acreage, it's not very much. Where do we go?
I can't take another question. Yeah. All those people. There's a lady up there who has asked before in red.
Yeah.
I really couldn't. What is the least toxic chemical pesticide for the home garden? I'm not sure that I could give you an answer to that off the top of my head. If you'd like to see me after, I can refer you to someone who probably could.
Way, way up there.
Way at the back? I could say that the question was, what would I say to the comment that chemicals are destroying the eco-balance? I could say that it's difficult to generalize about the statement. Certainly there are cases where one would have to say that it's true, the effects of the use of chemicals have been damaging to the environment without any question. And I think we're slowly beginning to recognize that one cannot willy-nilly use chemical fertilizer, pesticide, and so on without recognizing or trying to recognize its impact on the environment. But there are many other cases where if the chemical is used in an informed manner, it doesn't necessarily have to have a detrimental impact on the environment. Now, we could get hung up on semantics here, but I think that's a fair assessment of the situation.
Yes, way up there.
With regard to some specific traits.
Yeah, I would say that the correct statement would be that we have to determine the difference. I think that we don't have the tools to determine the difference. The chromatograph will show a little bit of difference. I think if you really want to find what the difference is, that if you take some organic grown food, that's chemically grown food, and you feed this to an animal, they have not biased judgment. I think you would have to use an animal.
Well, may I comment on your 3 points if I can remember them? First one was with regard to what I had said about differences or lack thereof between organic and non-organic, you can use those phrases, food materials, and I think you were making the point that I had already made in the paper that one can say that we do not have any evidence of differences, which is what I said, and what you're saying is that there may be some differences, and I fundamentally can't agree with you. What I said was we have no evidence of differences. Maybe there are some differences, but maybe they're in either direction. We don't know. As to the feeding of crops to animals, as you may know as well as I do, this has been undertaken in several long-term studies, and the results that have come forth have indicated in the conclusions no benefit for the use of an organic system compared to a system using chemical fertilizers. And as to the third point, which is the only other one I can remember, I think you're reiterating the same point I was making early in the paper, and that was that commercial agriculture as we operate it today has a very great energy dependence. It depends very largely on sources of energy that are not renewable. And this, as I said, is going to offer some challenges for agricultural science and technology for quite some time to come. But I do not subscribe to the idea that our society is going to revert to a Burmese rice paddy where the agricultural production is supported very little by energy and largely by labor. I just find it inconceivable to imagine that those of you sitting in this room are anxious to go out and work in a paddy 18, 20 hours a day.
Excuse me, but you've spoken. There's someone down here who hasn't had
a question yet.
That right here.
Question concerned the breakdown of elements in the soil, and that are there some that don't break down? Well, the utilization by the plant of nutrients really is at the elemental level, and breakdown beyond the elemental level is of no particular consequence. So I'm not quite sure that.
What I'm getting at is that normally in the chemical fertilizer you have nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash.
Yes. Right.
What about all the other elements that are required by the plant life?
Well, those are the three key elements on which fertilizers are commonly rated, but if a soil is analyzed and specific deficiencies of the 6 or 7 trace elements that are required by the plant are identified, these can be subsequently added with the fertilizer designed for a specific region or area.
Is it being done?
Oh, yes, widely.
Yes, way up there.
The question pertained to the iron that is added to foods as a replacement for any iron that might be lost during processing. Iron's a good case in point, I think, because the availability of iron to the human body varies tremendously among different forms. And this is a question that's still under some study. I don't really have firsthand knowledge myself in this particular area of the iron form that's added, but the evaluation of availability, excuse me, is normally done by some variation of what's referred to as a bioassay, where the iron is added to the material and then an appropriate diet created for a test animal that's deficient, and the material's evaluated against other sources of iron to determine its availability. If it's a low availability form that's being used, it may be necessary to add an increased amount. In other words, if it's only 50% available, you may have to add twice as much as if it was, say, 100% available or was the base material. I have no firsthand knowledge of iron being added intentionally in an unavailable form and any sort of misrepresentation. I'm sorry. I've spoken to Zach Sabry many times on Nutrition Canada, but I haven't discussed that particular issue with him.
Yes.
Sir, you mentioned the World Health Organization a few times.
Yes.
There is a book written by Professor Dr. Harold Bluthaus of the University of California, Berkeley campus.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Composting.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said that research and reference to many specialists and so on indicated that the ancient civilizations, which lasted a long time, where people were quite healthy and had good teeth till they died and so on, that they had one thing in common. They returned all organic material to the soil.
Mm-hmm.
One other point I would like to mention is that in a book called The Real American Tragedy, written by Edward C. Burgess,
mm-hmm.
he quotes Dr. Fogel, a surgeon and neurosurgeon of Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
who had specialized on the removal of cranial lesions, which I understand are cancerous types of growths. And the good doctor did some research on his own. He used 2 tons of organic compost on test plots for growing potatoes, and then he used ordinary commercial fertilizer on test plots in the same fields. And it was found that by using the organic compost, 2 independent laboratories who have good chemical reputations proved that the moisture content was reduced by 50%, the calcium and various other nutrients were doubled, and the ash was doubled. And the statement was made in his paper and in the book that this is an absolute proof that organic waste returned to the soil is of substantial value.
I can't repeat all of that, but I think you heard it all. I might say that the value of composting and the use of manures is not restricted to the United States. The Canada Department of Agriculture has just recently this year reissued a very good little bulletin with that title, I think, Manures and Compost, recommending procedures as to how to go about composting and how to incorporate manures. And I certainly would subscribe to the idea of returning organic matter to the soil. I think fundamentally it's a good idea. My only quibble with it, as I thought I had made clear, was with recommending it as the way to solve the world's food problem, because I don't see that as a realistic solution. As to the second point, I find the conclusions and the study very interesting. I would like to see it repeated, and I would like to see it in detail before assessing it. I suspect, and well, I know full well, that it's very easy to create differences, and it's very easy to find differences sometimes for random reasons in experimentation, and it usually requires that science attack a problem for a little while, even though its methods may seem to be sophisticated. It still takes some time for science to come to a conclusion on an issue. If, in fact, this gentleman's work stands investigation by other scientists in the tradition of science, then I'm sure that it will be adopted and assimilated.
I find that always when we have a vital subject like this, we could go on and on with questions, but I think we should draw to a close and perhaps have one more from someone who hasn't spoken before, please. Yes.
How long do tests for ill effects of additives have to be run before they're declared safe for use?
It varies. The question pertained to the length of testing for additives. It varies, but in almost all cases that I'm aware of, it's multi-generational with test animals. Of course, you cannot test with humans directly, or essentially that's out of the question, except in very rare cases. So it goes through lifetime tests, and in many cases, multi-generational tests with laboratory animals, and more than one, usually two or three.
I'd like to call on Dr. Vogt to thank our speaker.
This has been a night in which we've dispelled some myths. One of the myths which we've dispelled is the myth that people who dispel myths aren't popular, judging from this. Professor Richards, I think, has given us a great deal of practical information about scientific gardening. I hope not too much. That is, I hope that people don't, for instance, go and buy up all the nutmeg on the shelves in the city of Vancouver. And I don't know how many people here he's convinced. Listening to the questions, I think there are a lot of people who are going to continue with organic gardening, and that's probably a very good thing. There are some people who are convinced by his message, who maintain organic gardens. I number myself among those. I get a great deal of just sheer pleasure every spring in putting a ton of manure on my on my garden. You know, it's warm, actually.
Yeah.
You can see it. It has the right properties, and it may not be rational, but it is very pleasurable.
Psychological benefit.
And I think that that we will probably persist in doing this. It's rather like the Danish scientist Niels Bohr visited a friend of his who was also a scientist and saw that he had a horseshoe above his door. And he said, why do you have that? And he says, it's supposed to bring good luck. And he says, do you really believe that? He says, no, but it's supposed to work even if you don't believe in it.